obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
There. My name's Joe. I'm definitely an alcoholic. I always get a kick out of sitting up here. I like to look out into the audience, and then I see you all. You'll start fumbling through your itineraries, you know, the schedules and all that stuff, and you say, "Joe N. from Alabama."
But he looks Mexican. Thank God he's not in Arizona.
My sobriety date is March 17th of 1987. By the love and grace of you people and a precious, precious God I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful for that. I have this spiel that I was thinking about, but I got to tell a story about Father Terry. I every time I see him, it's just like it just. We were at a retreat. I don't know. It was back in sometime in the middle 90s, I guess, in Mississippi, and he was doing the retreat. He was the leader, and I went up there and I talked to him, and I said, "Father, I think God has a special plan for me. I've had these like really profound miracles in my life, and I think like I might be the chosen one." He may not remember this, but so he starts hitting me on my head. "You're too stupid to get it any other way." Oh my God, I love you. I do, man. Anyway, you can't not do this without saying thank you. You know, I met Kelly in Corpus Christi, and she said, "I'm going to get you to California." And here I am, you know. How in the world does that happen? I got sober in the back of a 1981 Ford station wagon. Yeah, you remember the big yellow ones with the woody panels? That I lived in that for a while. And now here I am, you know, playing golf with... Oh, my God. It's just, I cannot begin to express the gratitude that I have for you all for having me, and saying thank you is not enough, and it's just thank you for having us. My gratitude isn't always there, though. A few years ago, I was having one of those days. Now, I don't know if you're alcoholic like I am, but it doesn't matter how long you're here. You know, some people think, "Man, when I get 10 years, then I'm going to be spiritual like Vince, you know. Boy, if I could just get like Vince, then I'm going to have it. Well, when I get 15 years, then I'm going to be spiritual, you know, and I'm never going to feel this way again." Well, a few years ago, I was having one of those days, one of those real bad days. It seemed like the bills were bigger than the money, you know, the kids weren't, just life was just more than life on life's terms that I wanted to deal with. And so I was just wrenched up inside, just twisted and turned. And so I walked out of my house, and I was walking out to my car. And as I was walking out, there was a lady pulling a little boy in a wagon. And she was pulling this little boy in the wagon right up my street, and they live right down the street. And he's looking at me, and he's waving. And he had this striped overalls on, you know, those little Oshkosh by Gosh, those little cute ones with a little red hat. He had little red, little blue eyes and little red hair and freckles. Oh, my God. It was just a picture like from a Norman Rockwell scene. Except this little boy had Down syndrome. And he was just those little stubby fingers smiling at me. And I looked at that boy and I thought to myself, what in my life can possibly be so bad at this moment, you know, as I'm looking at him? And I just thought, for that brief moment, I thought, his defect of character, his flaw is what saved me today. What his little life, who we deem as handicapped or something, was served that day. And I came to find that that little boy died not too long after that. And you know what? That little boy changed my life. That little boy changed my life in a way I cannot explain to you. Except for this. I pray that God uses me and my defects of character, my monstrous ego, which you'll see in a little bit, I guarantee it, to carry that same message to you. I believe with all of my heart that there may be one of you who's going to leave here today who says, you know what, if this is as good as it gets, I might as well be drunk. And I hope that God uses me and my red wagon to change your life tonight so that you don't have to do that. I wake up every day with the idea that today's the day I'm going to meet you. And I don't know if I've done it yet, so here we go. Now, I wasn't always like that. You know, I never had always felt all this gratitude, and I wasn't always this overwhelming, bubbling, like, happy, joyous, and free kind of guy. I remember I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Cruces, New Mexico. By the way, I'm from New Mexico, not from Alabama, therefore the beaner. I walked into this meeting, and the girl that was chairing that meeting that day was Selma. And Selma was punk before Madonna was. This was like early 80s, you know. She had this purple hair, and she's,
no. My name is Selma, and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, I just know this and that.
She just went on, and I'm thinking to myself, man, that chick's an alcoholic. Or something's wrong with her. She's about a half bubble off level, you know. And I'm not anything like this girl. I don't know what in the world's going on with her, but she's got
the next lady starts talking, pretty redhead. My name's Jesse, and I'm an alcoholic. Blah, 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 blah.
And I start listening to this lady. Now, you got them in your meetings. You know, they look real normal, look like everything's all put together, and then they start talking. And then you start thinking, oh, my God. That chick is crazy, man. Well, I'm sitting here and I'm listening to this lady and I'm thinking, man, oh my God. They've got me mistaken. They've sent me to the wrong place. And I'm listening to this lady and she goes on and she finishes. It comes to the next guy, big old farmer in his overalls. And he says, my name's Ron and I know this. You stop drinking, change one day at a time and life gets better. And I'm thinking to myself, well, there you go. You just don't drink one day at a time. Come to these meetings and it gets better. And the next guy was a guy, he was sitting in this big puffy yellow chair. And he you knew he was there because you could smell him before you ever got there. This guy's hair was matted like a range dog, man. I mean, his glasses were so thick, I swear to you, I still can't believe that he could really see through them. They were taped with duct tape on both sides and on the bridge. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm thinking to myself, this guy, man. This is an alcoholic of the worst kind. And he's like, my name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober by the grace of God. I'm the last of the real hobos. And I'm looking, I'm thinking, you are a hobo, dude. You know, man, you, wow. And I knew from the second that I stepped in that meeting, I was not like these people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was different than them. You see, I wasn't anything like any of these people. I have deep-rooted social, psychological, psychiatric, emotionally scarred, deep, deep, penetrating wounds of the kind that aren't... That turn people like me into serial killers and stuff like that. I'm not anything like these people. And I was absolutely convinced that I was not like these people because, you see, I believe that God has a baby-making machine. And God has this giant baby-making machine. He sits there with this foot pedal. You know? And he's shooting these babies out. And then there's these little Oompa Loompa-looking little characters, you know? Just like Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory. And he walks up there, Oompa, Doompa, Doompa-dee-dee. And God pushes the button, baby pops out. He catches the baby, walks him over to the bassinet, tucks him in the bassinet, and he says, okay, he's ready. And he looks at the other one, he says, okay, I'll be right there. And he comes over and he's got this book.
And he's got this book, and as he walks up to this bassinet, he tucks this book in that bassinet with that baby, and they send him on his way. They keep shooting these babies out, tuck them in the bassinet, books, boom, 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 every single one of them get one. February 3rd, 1962, about 8:03 in the morning, guy shoots the baby out. He catches him, wraps him up in the in his little swaddling clothes, puts him in the bassinet, and he says he's ready for his book. And the other one looks at him and says, "We're out of books." And they look back at each other and say, "Well, what do you mean he's out of books? What do we do? He said, "Well, send him on his way. Just send him on his way." And that's exactly what they did. They sent me on my way without a book. Now, you see, this is not just a normal, everyday, normal little book that people get tucked in with. This is the book of life. This book has every answer to everything you're ever going to do, how you're going to do it, who you're going to do it with, every single thing. 2.3 kids, one German Shepherd, one Chihuahua. Your son's going to play football at Alabama. Slide that in their national championship. Your son's going to play football. Your daughter's going to be this. They're going to have this. And da-da-da-da-da. Everybody's going to be just absolutely perfect. And in that book, there it is. But they sent me on my way without that book. And so what happens to people like me without their book is, you see, I didn't learn how to hit a baseball. And I was that fat little kid on the end of the bench. Oh, was the last one picked on the team, you know. Full count, bases loaded, one run, you know, is all we need to win the game, and Joe's got to go bat. You know I'm going to strike out. I didn't get a book, man. I don't know how to swing a baseball bat. And sure enough, the pitch comes, I strike out, and there I am, the loser, the little kid who can't hit a baseball. A little bit later, you know, I grew up in a Catholic church, and my family was really, really devout Catholics, and I had to become an altar boy, and so I become this altar boy. And the two guys that were doing my training were kind of back there in the back with me, and these guys got books, and their books were pranksters. So they would tell me, "Okay, ring the bells, ring the bells." So I'd be sitting back there, ringing the bells, man. I mean, just tearing it up. And the priest is looking back at me like, "Oh, no, 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 no." This guy's directly off the boat from the Vatican, can't even speak English, and he's like, "Da, da, da, da." Well, see, I didn't know, because I don't have a book, that there's a specific time you ring the bells in a church. So I'm just ringing them during his mass. Then my little prankster friends decide to tell me, "Hey, it's time to go get the wine and the water. Go get the wine and the water." So there I go, you know. I go get the wine and the water, and I'm standing there like an idiot. And the priest is like, "Da, da, 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 da. I don't have a book, Father, you know. When? How? What do you do?" And that's how I felt. Everything I did always seemed to be I was the laughingstock. I was the fat kid. I was the kid that everybody made fun of. "Hey, salami, you know, here comes Roly-Poly Joe, da, 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 da." There was always all this stuff going on in my life. And it was all because I didn't get books. Now, I didn't know that. But I know that there was something inside of me that didn't feel right. I love the description in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It says men and women drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation so elusive that we cannot, after a time, differentiate true from the false. The restless, irritable, and discontent. And that was me. I call that not having a book. Another little word I like to, the heebie-jeebies. You know, that feeling of impending doom. That always something's not right feeling that's always just lurking there. It precedes you, it follows you, it encompasses you. It's always all around you, the heebie-jeebies. And I felt like that was me, you know, that no matter what, I didn't know that I knew that, but it was there. I mean, certainly when you strike out and all the other kids are making fun of you, there's something wrong. And one day, my cousin and I decided that we were going to steal a bunch of my... Well, let me backtrack. You know what they do with people who don't have books? They drop them in villages with people who didn't get books either. Yeah. They put me in a village of people in Las Cruces, New Mexico, with a bunch of people who didn't get their books, and they were just winging it. And they were just going by, and they were this, it was kind of like this Mexican colony, you know? And we don't have parties, we have fiestas, man. But my cousin's here today, he lives here, and we were talking about how we used to pull the trucks around, and everybody tuned in on the same radio station and build a big old bonfire in the middle. I said, oh yeah, man, that's our parties. And there was always a keg in the middle of it. You know, and it would be for the big birthday party on Saturday, which was Joe's party. He's only this little kid. But there's this bonfire going, and what I always noticed is that as soon as that keg got tapped and that beer started to flow, that the intensity level of our parties always seemed to escalate. They always seemed to get a little bit louder, and the fish got bigger. And the stories just kept on getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And everybody was like, and I'm sitting there and I'm watching all of this stuff. And there's my heroes. There's my grandpa. There's my cousin Bobby. There's my uncle Eddie. There's Leo, Johnny, my dad. And they're telling the stories. Hey, man, Bobby, tell him about that deer. Tell him about that deer. You know, and so I'm sitting there. Yeah, Bobby, tell us a story about the deer, you know. Tell me the story about the deer. And Bobby's getting ready, and he says, well, you know, I was sitting up on that rock, and I was looking down at him. It was this big old 10-point buck. And I was getting ready to take my shot, and as I took my shot, the gun jammed. And I'm sitting there thinking, what did you do, Bobby? What did you do? So I jumped on him and I stabbed him. Oh, and man, and so I'm thinking down, oh, my God. When I get big, you know what people without books do? You become like Bobby. My deal is that as soon as my family doesn't just kill deer, they choke them, you know? And I'm going to be the best deer choker. I'm going to be the best dad. I'm going to be the best at everything there was. And in my mind, I'm developing these ideas of how you go about becoming that person. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, oh my God. And then all of a sudden, like a shot across the fire. Hey, Leo, where's my lawnmower, man? I love it. You know why it always gets quiet in here? Because you all know where the lawnmower is. It's at the pawn shop, huh? Yep. And Leo ain't got the funds to get the lawnmower out. And the next thing you know, Leo and Johnny are rolling around in the fire, beating the hell out of each other, and the cops got to come to separate this party. And the big birthday party for Joe on Saturday isn't so big anymore. And just 13 seconds ago, what was absolute elation, Bobby choking deers, man, I'm going to be like them. Now it turns into this monstrous fear as they're beating the heck out of each other. And I'm rolling back and forth and I'm thinking to myself, you see, this is what happens in villages with people without books. And I'm sitting in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my name is Selma and I'm an alcoholic. And yeah, I know this, you don't drink and drink. And I'm saying, I hope that works for you, honey. But you don't understand. I have unbelievably deep-rooted psychological, sociological, psychiatric, emotional scars that are beyond understanding. And I'm not like you people. You stop drinking, you get better. It doesn't work that way for me. So I'm sitting one day, me and my cousin go out into this, we go out and take a bunch of my grandpa's beer, and we went out into this cotton field. Now I was about, I was about 12 or 13 years old. And we go out into this cotton field, and I remember popping the top to that thing. And I popped the top of that beer, and I sat there, and I remember smelling it, and I remember pinching my nose, and I remember pouring it back. And I remember it tingled and it fizzed. And I don't know if on the second drink or not, I held my nose. But then, the clouds parted and the Oompa Loompas They dropped that book. They found it. And all of a sudden, that feeling of restless, irritable, and discontentedness went away. And my alcoholic life was the only normal one. The sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks we see others taking with impunity. I was a kid. And I didn't become an everyday alcoholic at that time, but I will tell you this. I don't know what I had for lunch yesterday, but I remember that moment in that cotton field. That moment in that cotton field, I felt like I fit for the first time in my life. And it didn't matter if that maybe just with the morning glory or with the cotton or whatever, but somehow or another, I fit. And I had never fit like that before. And that sense of ease and comfort and that craving, the phenomenon of craving, was set in me, and it set a cycle in motion. Now you see, there's the sentences or two that are right before that says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation's so elusive that they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. And their alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. In other words, for me, that's kind of like, I then believe my own lies. I think that's the way that my perception was altered to a point that I could no longer differentiate true from the false. And so what I started to believe about myself and everybody else was, is that you all are perfectly normal. You all function at a level that's right here, but I'm down here because I didn't get a book like you did. So in order for me to function like you, I have to perform at a level that's this much higher than you, just so that I'll see myself at the same level that you're at. And so that means that I tell you what I think you need to hear. I do whatever it takes to win you over. I do whatever it takes. Well, I have a hunting story that I'd like to share with you myself. As a matter of fact, I brought my trophy with me. I was sitting up on a rock when my gun jammed. And I jumped down on him and I choked him. I brought this one because it's easier to carry in the plane, but my unicorn, I thought about bringing it, but I thought, well, I will go to the grave defending the fact that I killed this jackalope. And I don't care whether you believe in them or not, I will absolutely go to the grave believing that my alcoholic life is the normal one and you don't understand. And when you call me a liar and when you call me all these other things and you're saying, Joe, man, they're not real. No, they are. So elusive that after a time we can no longer differentiate the true from the false, and their alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. And as I sat in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that day, I wasn't like those people. And I would have gone to the grave. You see, if a mere code of morals or better philosophies that have been sufficient to change my life, I'd have done it a long time ago. But you don't understand, I didn't get a book. Where, on what page is my book that says, you don't do this and this is what happens? Well, one of the things that I did, because I'm either 110 on the freeway or I'm flat broke down on the side of the road. I played football in high school. And I was one of those guys, the go-to guy. You know, get in there, Joe. Offense, defense, kickoff, return. This last season, I don't know if any of you all watch college football or not. There might be a few of you here. But there was a Brandon Spikes that poked the guy in the eye. You know, remember they were showing him and sticking his fingers in the helmet, you know, and poking the... I find that perfectly acceptable. I say if you can get your mouth around your ankle or their ankles, bite it hard. Get them out of the game, whatever it takes. It doesn't matter. I got to perform at a level that's this much higher so that you'll understand. You see, I can't just go ask you out on a date. Because if you really knew what I was like, you'd never go out with me. So I have to look like this. And my ego has to perform at this level that's so much greater than everybody else so that you just kind of
And I'd walk down that hallway and I'd have that jacket on, all those, you know, the badges, man. Yeah, you guys got books, man, but I don't need them. I'm bad. I was afraid is what I was. Terrified of my own shadow. Well, probably my most very favorite sentence in the book, in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, says this. Is he not the victim of the delusion that he can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if only he manages well? And I've got this idea that only if I manage well, if I just get things squared away, if I get all the outside all squared away and I get my life all settled and organized so that I can look like you do or like I perceive you to look, then I'll be okay. Then I'll be happy. Well, you know, I have another example. And you know how back in, I haven't seen one in a long time, but remember those cartoons where they used to have a donkey pulling a cart? And that donkey would be pulling that cart, but he wouldn't go anywhere. He was a stubborn ass, right? And so this stubborn ass would just sit there. And so they figured out that if they took a carrot and tied it to the end of a stick and led that in front of that donkey would go anywhere they wanted to. So what they did is they took this little carrot and they hung it out in front of that donkey. And wherever they needed him to turn right, they'd turn it over to the right and he'd try to get it. Well, I'm the victim of the delusion that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if only I manage well. You see, me and that donkey, we're a lot alike. The only difference between me and that donkey is I hold my own carrot. Think about that. And I'll let myself just get that close, and as soon as I get that close, then I move it again. Because enough is never enough. I can't get happy enough. There's another little story I like to tell. My wife and I came home one day, and we had teenage daughters, and our daughters were sitting there, and they were just being teenagers, and they were sitting watching TV and sitting with the remote, you know, dishes piled up. Yeah, many of you all know exactly what I'm talking about. Dishes piled up. Dust on the furniture. You could grow corn on our furniture. Vacuum hadn't been done. I mean, just it was a terrible mess. And every time I'd come home, there would be this restless, irritable, just heebie-jeebies preceded me before I ever walked in the house because I knew what I was going to walk into. And I'm thinking to myself, if I could only get them to do right, then our house will be happy. And I won't yell at them, and then they'll like me, and then their mom won't be mad at me, and you know, and it'll all work out. So I came up with this ingenious idea, and I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take the chores, write them out, put them in a hat, let everybody pick one, and then we're going to do our chores. Ingenious. Absolutely wonderful, brilliant plan. I'm a mastermind. So I write the chores, I hand them all out, everybody gets one, Jennifer gets dishes, Gloria's got the dusting, Carla's got vacuuming, Clara was doing something else, and I was doing something else. And I'm watching my symphony. And I'm over here, Jennifer's washing dishes now, Gloria's dusting, and out of the corner of my eye, I see Carla's over here vacuuming. And Carla was vacuuming like this. No rhythm, no organized fashion, no, just, I mean, just randomly vacuuming in every single direction. And I said to her, Carla, you're not vacuuming right. You gotta vacuum in lines. And then you gotta cross cut. So in case you don't get all the dust one way, you get it the other way. And she looked at me and she said, Joe, you know what? For you, it'll never be right. And you know what? She was right. And she's right because she would have gone in little lines north and west, north and south, and I would have said, you start out east and west. I'm the victim of the delusion that I'll be happy when I manage well. And nothing is ever good enough. I remember I was sober for a few years, and finally, you know, God had blessed me with this. I'd gotten a good job. I graduated from college. All the miracles that God only knows I should have never, ever happened. But
And so I got this job, and I got this new truck, and it's S10, you know, little extended cab. I mean, CD player, power windows. I came from an 81 Ford station wagon. And I've got this brand new truck, and I'm sitting in my truck, and I'm just crying. Oh, God, you're so good. You're so, Alcoholics Anonymous has blessed me beyond understanding, and and I'm sitting in my little truck, and I pull out of the dealership, I turn on, come to the light, and I'm sitting there, and I look in my rearview mirror, and this big black four-wheel drive Z71's coming up next to me. And this guy's got this hot little blonde sitting next to him, you know? So, I was sitting in my little truck, and I was thinking, oh, if I had that truck, I'd be happy. Enough is never enough. And I've got this idea that if I could only overcome such and such. You know, my heroes, they tell those stories, and I've got this idea that if I could only be like my heroes, if I could only be like my cousin Bobby, if I could only be like that. And then the other part of me saying, but no, I can't do that. My dad would come home. I remember when at those little parties, he'd come home, and I'd be, you know, sitting in there, and it'd be 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and there were heroes in my life, but none was like my dad. And then he'd come in, and he'd be drunk and knocking things over, and I'd hear my mom, "Where's the money for the rent? Where's the money for the rent?" And the next thing I know, you know, I hear this yelling, and then I hear this punching. And then I'd wake up in the morning and I'd find my mom, and she'd have bruises all over her arms and her eyes and all these other things. And I think to myself, I am never going to be like that guy. I am absolutely never going to be like my dad. Now, every one part of me said I wanted to be exactly like my dad. And the other part of me says the last thing in the world I'll ever be is like my dad. And I try to live somewhere in the middle. I live in this delusion that if I could only be the best dad, if I could only be the best husband. Well, I graduated from high school because I played football. It was probably the only real reason. And I graduated from high school. I went to a frat party. There were chicks in hot shorts, you know, and kegs. And so I joined the fraternity that night. I mean, that was what you do, you know. I'm sitting in that fraternity. I'm going to all the meetings. I'm the little, you know, the Animal House guy. And about 2 weeks later, they asked me if I was ever going to enroll in school, and I thought, well, that might not be a bad idea. So I enrolled in school, and I flunked out, and next thing I know, I'm getting kicked out of school, and I got this job, and this job moved me to another place, and I walked into this restaurant, and this manager was talking. I was actually moved up into a position of management, and I got to be honest with you. I've been sober now 23 years, and in my early talks, it was a steakhouse. Degrees of humility, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a number of fourth and fifth steps, blah, 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 blah. It was a fast food joint that sold steak fingers. Okay, the program's working. And so I walked in there, and this guy's talking to this young lady, and he says, "This is so-and-so, and I'd like you to meet Joe. He's going to be our new manager. He's going to be one of our new assistant managers, da-da-da-da-da. And you know, you all talk, and tomorrow you both will start tomorrow." So I said, "Hey, how'd you like to go out and have a drink with me? We'll get married. I'll beat the hell out of you. You'll have my kid, and then we'll never see each other again." She kind of thought about it, and I guess she thought, well, sounds like a plan, and that's exactly what happened. I got married to that little girl, I don't know, just very, very shortly thereafter, that first time that we met. I'd go out, and everything in me said, "Don't spend the money, don't spend the money, don't spend the money." But everything in me said, "One more beer, one more beer, one more beer." And I'd go out, and before I knew it, I'd come home, and it'd be 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and she'd be saying, "Where's the money for the rent? Where's the money for the rent?" And she'd wake up in the morning with bruises and black eyes, and I'm thinking to myself, how in the world did I become everything I swore to God I'd never be? And I started hating myself. And that restless, irritable, and discontentedness started to get more and more. The heebie-jeebies kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the more they would grow, the more my plan would grow. I would, you know, I'm going to come up with a better plan this time. I'm going to do this better. I'm going to do that better. I'm going to get a better job. I'm going to... Cuervo, please. And there'd always be that moment of relief. And then the punches again. And one year and 3 hours later, I'm sitting in front of a judge, and that young lady is sitting there with a petition for divorce and 6 months pregnant. And we got divorced, and she had a little boy, and I could not tell you where he is to this day. I had become everything I said I would never be. I hated myself more than words can describe to you. And you know what you do when you hate yourself? You come up with a better plan. And my plan was, there was always another plan and another plan and another plan. And I ran out of plans. And somehow or another, I ended up in a meeting. I ended up and went home, and I just was falling apart. And I ended up in a treatment center in El Paso, Texas. And there was a lady there by the name of Patty Parks. And Patty Parks was was our counselor, and she would talk about, you know where people like you end up, Joe? Jails, institutions, and death. Jails, institutions, and death. And I'm saying, yeah, that's where people like me, people without books, end up, because they don't know what to do next. And I'm not saying that to her, but that's exactly what's coming out of my mouth. And I got out of that treatment center, and I went to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there sat Selma, and there sat Jesse, and there sat Ron, and there sat Bob. And all I could do was look at them and say, God, I wish I were alcoholic so I could just stop drinking and my life would get better. But I'm not like you. I have deep-rooted social, psychological, psychiatric, emotional scars that you don't understand. And so I'd try to get her back. Better plan this time. Something a little bit more. And Cuervo, please. And I'd go back out. And I'd come back in. My name's Yama, I'm an alcoholic. And she had pink hair this time, you know? I come back, and they have these meetings on Saturday mornings, and Bob would be there, and Bob had this, what he would always do is he would take his napkin, and he would make this pocket, and he would fill it with donuts and Danish, you know, and take these coffee cups, and he would fill that pocket, and he would go back into the corner, and he would take these coffee, and he would pour it down, and he would stuff his mouth with these donuts that were so full, I thought to myself he was going to choke himself to death. And I'm thinking to myself, help that guy, somebody, please. That's an alcoholic, and I'm not like that guy. I have a wife problem. I got to get my wife back. I got to get my kid back. I got to get my license. I got to get that gun out of Hawk. I got to get that lawnmower. As soon as I get all that stuff, then I'll be back, and we'll talk about your steps and stuff. But right now, you don't understand. I got other problems. And I'd go back out again. And one day I'm sitting at the Blue Moon Bar up in north of Las Cruces, and this girl grabs my hand. Come on, you're Mexican, let's dance. I said, hell, let's get married. I'll beat the hell out of you. You can have my kid, and I'll never see you again either. And that's exactly what happened. That young lady had my daughter, and I don't know where they're at to this day. All the plans aren't coming together. I don't know. I was thinking about this today. I was thinking about, you know that commercial with that guy? He sees that girl in the train, and just all fast forwards, and they're watching their kid get inaugurated. You know, well, that's kind of like me, but I'm thinking I'm that guy in your book, in your camera. You know, am I the guy? And I'm walking around looking for everybody to say, please tell me I'm yours. Please, please make me real. You know, because I need validation in some way or another. I can't get it. I can't get it. Heebie-jeebies. Cuervo, please.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Ah. Now, by this time, I knew I had a problem with alcohol. It doesn't take a rocket scientist. And so I decide I'm going to go into treatment again, and this is about my fourth or fifth trip into, about my fourth trip into treatment. And I went in there, and my daughter was born, and her and me and her mother are going to work to try to work things out. And I get out, and this time I decide, well, I'm just going to take Anabuse, you know, and I'm going to take Anabuse, I'm going to go to these meetings, and I'm not going to drink anymore, and I'm going to show her that I'm not going to be that person like that anymore. And so I'm taking this Anabuse, and I'm going to these meetings. And I go to these meetings, and there's Selma, Jesse, Bob.
My name is Bob, and I'm the last of the real hobos, sober by the grace of God.
And I'd look at Bob, and I'd think to myself, oh, my God, I'm nothing like this dude. Except that I noticed there was something different about Bob. His hair was still matted. He still had the same stinking clothes on, which I don't think he'd ever washed since the first time I'd seen him. But he had new glasses on. And you guys, I can't tell you to this day how much every time I think about those new glasses, how those glasses impacted me. How does a dude like that get new glasses? You know, I'm thinking, how am I going to get my wife back, all this other stuff, and I'm still scratching my head thinking, but man, he doesn't have duct tape anymore. And the program was working in his life, and my life was falling apart. I'm having to smell my clothes to see what smells like the best to wear today, because I'm living in the back of a car. And I'm looking and living more like Bob every single day, but I'm not like him. He's an alcoholic, and this program is working for him. And I'd go to these meetings, and I'd sit, and I'd listen, and I'd think to myself, I just did, but and Christmas Eve of 1986, me and her were supposed to get together. She was going to bring the baby. I went out and bought this dress. I'm doing this menial job, you know, and I'm sitting. I've been eating this Anabuse since August, and they don't show up.
Restless, irritable, discontent. No meetings, no sponsor, no steps, no God, no just Anabuse.
When suddenly the thought crossed his mind. Surely one drink, like the book says, one drink of whiskey with his milk wouldn't hurt. When suddenly the thought crossed my mind, one drink on Anabuse won't hurt me. You know, Thirst Busters, Circle K had just come out with those Thirst Busters, those Spiggle 64-ounce cups. So, and I share this every single time I talk, and I say this exactly the same way, because I don't know if it's for you or for me, but I went and I got that big old cup, and I filled it with the fifth of Tanqueray. I splashed some tonic in there, I squeezed a lime, and as God is my witness, I believed, surely this one drink on Anabuse won't hurt. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And it was only one drink. And so I took that drink, and if ever I needed relief, that was a moment when I needed that relief. You know what I'm talking about. That sense of ease and comfort that comes at once with the kicker. I like to think of it kind of like mushrooms at first stage. Tingling all up and down my arms, my chest. No, I don't remember this like this in the cotton field. And my chest was just pounding. I thought my heart was going to jump out of my chest. And when it felt like all of a sudden somebody took a 2x4 and then just smashed me in the stomach. And I just bent. I remember I bent over. I was at this party and it was New Year's Eve. And I'm sitting here and I am just, for the convention version, every orifice on my body was occupied. Something was coming out of somewhere, everywhere. I laid on that floor and I sat there rolled up in a ball just thinking, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done? I thought, I'm gonna die, man. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, it's gotta stop. Please stop. And I said, I am never gonna do this again. And that whole night was just hell. And I said, I am never going to do this again. And I will tell you what, that next morning I quit taking Anabuse, man. We have but two alternatives. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other was to accept spiritual help. And I wasn't ready for spiritual help. I know that I made somewhat of a conscious decision at that point. Everything I did was a failure. Everything I did, and for the next couple of months, all I did was just absolutely try to drink myself to death. No matter what, I'd wake up and the heebie-jeebies were already up doing push-ups, you know, and there was something, I just had to change the way I felt, and if I could come up with $10, I'd drive down to Juarez, Mexico, I'd get me an old bottle of tequila and a bucket of Coronas, and I'd come back home, and, you know, and, now, I won't even get into that Corona. Anyway, and I'd go down there and I'd come back, and it was all I could do. If I could make it to the bar and steal a pitcher off your table when you weren't looking, that's how I survived. I'd go to these, happy hours where they had free tacos and stuff, and that was what I lived on. And everything I did was just to get drunk. And one day I didn't have enough money and I didn't have anywhere to go. And my mom by this time had said, Joe, I love you with all my heart, but I cannot have you continue to kill yourself like this. And I can't let you do this in our house. I can't let your sister watch you, and I can't let your brother watch you, and you're no longer welcome here. And oh, man, you talk about socially, psychological scarring. Mama's done kicked her baby out. And oh, my God, I didn't have anywhere to go. And so one night I ended up at my grandma's house. And I'll go into grandma's because you can always count on grandma. And I went into my grandma's. I said, Grandma, do you mind? I had not been drinking that day. And I said, Grandma, do you mind if I take a shower? And she said, oh, no, mijo, come on in. Let me make you some enchiladas. And so my grandma's in there making enchiladas. And my hero, now there was Bobby and my dad and Eddie and all the guys that were my heroes. But there was no hero like my grandpa. My grandpa was the top of the food chain. This was the man. I remember one day he was sitting hammering, you know, he worked in construction, and he hit his thumb and the hammer flies off. Oh, try that, Superman, like my grandpa. So I go in there, my grandpa's watching a ball game, and I go in there and I sit down, I'm going to take a shower, and he's sitting there and he starts looking at me, and of course he's been drinking, and he looks at me and says, you know what's wrong with you, man? Oh, God, no, Grandpa, not you too, please.
You just gotta be a man. You just gotta get responsible, man. You gotta just start doing what's right. Oh, oh, oh.
And I'm sure with love, he was trying to tell me that message, you know, that you tell that boy, grow up, it's time. And all I'm thinking is Grandpa, you don't understand. I have deep-rooted social psychological issues, and I can't do that. Now, I'm not saying that, and I'm not thinking that, but I'm thinking, Grandpa, don't you think that if I could do that, I wouldn't? I would have done it by now. You think I meant to get up every day and beat my girlfriend or beat my wife? Do you think I mean to not pay my bills? Do you think I want to live in the back of a car? Do you think it's my choice that my mom would kick me out of the house? If a mere code of morals or better philosophies were sufficient, we'd have done it a long time ago. And I didn't want to be the way that I was. And I could not stop. And now I'm sitting there with my grandpa. And my grandpa gets up. And I get up. And I'm going to leave. And next thing I know, we bump into each other. And he says, you know what you need, man? You need a part of me, man. And I'm like, Grandpa, here we go. The bonfire again, you know? Grandpa, I'm not going to fight you, I told him. No, you need me. I'll show you, man. I'll straighten you out. I'll make a man out of you. And I'm like, Grandpa, I'm not going to fight my grandfather. And one thing led to another. We ended up outside, and my grandma's trying to get in the middle of us, and he hits my grandmother, and my grandmother falls to the ground. And I don't know what happened. I just went off. And I've always been blessed with some, like, We call it country song in Alabama. And I just beat and beat and beat that man. And it wasn't about beating my grandpa. And it wasn't about, it was just this rage, this stuff inside. And as I laid there, I kicked him and I kicked him and I broke his ribs. And I remember his mouth was just hanging. His eyes were swollen shut. And they had to pull me off of him. And I'm looking down at him thinking to myself, oh my God, the only man in my life. And I'm thinking, if this is what life is, I don't want it. And I left there and I remember I called my mom and I told her, I said, Mom, this is it. I'm done. I had stolen some money from this guy, and I went to this motel room, and I sat there, and I remember I was drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking and smoking and trying to make the heebie-jeebies go away. Now, some of you alcoholics know this place. Some of you haven't got there yet. But if you know this place, you know what I'm talking about. When you drink and you can't make the monsters go away. The book describes it perfectly. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. The four horsemen. And I couldn't make it go away. This motel room is right next to my grandmother and grandfather's house and right next to my mom's house. And as I sat there and I watched, I talked to my mom and I watched her go off, and I guess they tried to go find me. And I went over to my dad's house. I got one of his guns and I went back to that motel room. And I said, if this is it, I'm going to die. Now, some people talk about, you know, it was a cry for help, blah, 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 blah. No, I wanted to die. And I could not get drunk enough. When all of a sudden, Patty parks his head. I call this my Alice in Wonderland experience. Patty parks his head starts floating around the room. Jails, institutions, and death. Oh my, jails, institutions, and death. Oh my, jails, institutions, and death. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, man. And it's like she's just floating around the room, you know, this Cheshire cat. And I'm like, and all of a sudden, for whatever reason, I don't know what it is, that moment of alcoholic clarity, whatever you want to call it, jails, not the jails I'd been locked up in, but the jail that I lived in up here. Institutions, not the institutions in the treatment centers and the psych wards and all that other stuff. The institution that says I'm this way because I didn't get a book. And the death, not the death of me getting wrapped in that old car around some tree on the way home drunk one night, or getting shot by some guy's wife, but the death I was living one day at a time. And I don't know, for whatever reason, I just put everything down and I took my hands, I threw them in the air, and I said, God, I don't know what you are. I don't know who you are, but I can't go one more second like this. Please help me. And I have not had a mood-altering chemical since that day. I ended up in treatment. I ended up in treatment again. And I got out. And I don't know. You know, it's just they say that when the student's ready, the teachers appear. I walked into the Arid Club in Las Cruces, and Ken Shorley was standing there making coffee. I walked straight up to him. I didn't go anywhere else. The first thing I did is I said, I'm going to get a sponsor. And I walked up to Ken and I said, Ken, will you be my sponsor? And he looked at me and he said, hell no. Woo, no, 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 buddy. I've been watching you for the last few years, and nah, that's a pleasure somebody else could have. And I said, Ken, I'll do anything. And he looked down. You know what I'm talking about. You all have had him. That guy that comes up to you and asks you to sponsor him, and you're like, oh, my God, man. Oh, anybody but you. You're looking for the asterisk, you know, in that. Anytime, anywhere, anyone reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there, except Joe Nieto. And he shook his head, and he looked down, and he said, oh, man. You're going to do it exactly the way I tell you, Joe. And the day you don't, you call me with the name of your new sponsor. And I said, oh, yes, sir. And he took that big book and he opened it that very first meeting, that first time that I asked him. And he opened it to the very first page. Now, I don't know if you've ever read that, but it's very interesting words in that first couple of sentences. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly helpless, hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely, in italics, how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And he said, we are going to do it precisely like this book, Joe. He said, any less would steal from the people that'll follow you in AA, and any more will surely be my ego. And I love this, and I say this every time I speak, and if you have a sponsor who doesn't use this book, you don't have a sponsor. He took that book and he opened it up. And he said, the first thing I want you to do is I want you to go to meetings and I want you to not drink in between. I said, I can do that. So for the first year, and I say this not because I'm bragging, but because I was literally just terrified. For the first year, I went to 3 meetings a day, every single day, without fail. I did not miss one single meeting for a whole year. Not for the pat on the back, but because I didn't know if I could go from noon until 8 without going to a 5:30 meeting. And so I just went to meetings and I didn't drink in between. Now, he said the other thing he did is he said, well, let me ask you a question. He says, it seems to me like you're kind of backwards in these steps. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, the first step, he said, do you admit you're powerless over alcohol? Oh, man, remember that Ann abuse? Oh, yeah, buddy. He says, yeah, I think you got that. He said, but what does it mean to you that our lives have become unmanageable? You see, a lot of people like to think that that's 2 steps. It's not 2 steps. That's a hyphen. Grammatically speaking, a hyphen does not separate. It connects. It's not a comma. It's not a parenthesis. It's not a period. It's a connection. It's not a bridge. It is one and the same. I am powerless over my unmanageable life. You cannot cure an alcoholic mind with an alcoholic mind. And that's exactly what I try to do. I'm the victim of the delusion. So you see, the first time I went into treatment, I went in there and I thought, well, I'm the AA happy poster child, you know? And I became the kid who worked the steps in 3 days. And then drunk on the 4th day, and I couldn't figure out why. And Ken explained to me, he said, you see, you've got this idea that if you can only get the outside to make the inside feel better, then everything's going to be okay, but it's not that way. I believe, and I say this is my own opinion, and you might take it for whatever it's worth, but I believe the single greatest mistake I have ever made in my recovery is to judge my sobriety on how I feel on any given day. My feelings have nothing to do with my spirituality, because what I start doing is I start chasing again. I got to go to more meetings. I got to pray more. I got to Cuervo, please. That's what happens next, even with working these steps. And Ken explained that to me, and for the first time in my life, I got it. Huh. Now, that was on a Sunday when I got out of treatment. On Monday, I went to the Monday night men's stag meeting. And I walked into that Monday night men's stag meeting, and I'm sitting there, and it's a big circle, and the guy that's chairing the meeting is about 2 or 3 down from me, and it's coming over my way, and the topic that night is hitting bottom. And so they start talking, and guy talks, and the next guy talks, and I'm sitting here thinking about my speech. Hell, I've been out of treatment a day now. And I'm thinking about how bad my bottom is. I'm 25 years old. Oh, my God. Married and divorced 2 times. I've got kids I've never seen. Blah, 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 blah. And, man, I start just blah, 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 blah. Is that what you guys say around here? When all of a sudden, this little Mexican from the other side of the room gets up and starts marching at me. Shut up, you little boy, shut up. And he reaches in his eye and he pops this glass eye out of his head and he's holding this eyeball up in front of me and he said, shut up, you little boy, shut up. You don't know nothing about hitting bottom. He said, 28 years I spent on Skid Row. 28 years I spent on Skid Row. And you come in here and you talk about your little girlfriends. Look in my eye, I don't even know where it is. Look at my fingers. I think they're in Phoenix or somewhere. I'm not even sure. Shut up. yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. I remember sitting there thinking, I remember feeling like I was taking massive amount of cotton and taking it out of my ears and stuffing it in my mouth. And at that point, I realized I don't know all I think I know. That guy's name was Roger. And Ken and I continue to work these steps, and he took this piece of paper and he asked me, he says, what do you think about God, Joe? What do you think about your higher power? So we started talking about it, and he gave me a piece of paper, and I drew a line down the middle of it, and like he told me to do, and he said, write on one side what you think God is, and on the other side what you think God is not. I said, okay. And so I had this list of what God wasn't. You know, oh man, I had a list. And then I took that other side and I wrote down just a couple of words, and he took that piece of paper. He never even looked at it. He ripped that paper in half and he handed me the God is part and he said, here's your higher power. This AA. It takes the fight out of you. I can't argue with you your views of Alcoholics Anonymous, God, Buddhism, Christianity, this is my God. Now who am I going to argue with? Me? So it's like this catch 22. He said, now you got to make a decision to turn your life and will over to the care of that power that you believe in. And here's that other part. Here's this other part. I was a few years sober when I was reading that step one day, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. I, for some reason or another, came to believe in. Now you ponder that when you leave here. It's not asking me to believe in anything. It's just believing that something's going to work. And now I had this piece of paper, and all I had to do was make a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of that power, which was evident by the step I followed it up with, which is the fourth step. And Ken told me, Joe, you have 7 days to finish your fourth step. 7 days? I told him, I can't do that in 7 days. He said, what's the name of your new sponsor? I said, I'll do it, man. I'll do it. So I get through the fourth step, and we get through this third step and make this, you know, and he asked me, who do you want to do your fifth step with? And I said, no offense to you, but I really want to do it with Roger. And he said, that Roger's a perfect choice. So Roger and I made the date. I'd finished the fourth step, and I went over to his house, and we're sitting there. And Roger's lived in this little one-room efficiency apartment. And he's sitting there, and he's got this table, and he's got a Big Chief tablet and a Husky pencil. Remember in first grade some of you are too young to know that, but remember those big old pencils and a Big Chief tablet, man? Not for me, I guess, but. And he said, what are we going to do, Joe? I said, well, the book says that I'm supposed to tell you all my life stories. That's good. He says, okay, let's get started. And so we start, you know. And so I've got this four step laid out exactly the way Ken told me to lay it out. I've got resentment, cause, effects, and this blank column on this side. And Roger tells me, what I'd like you to do is write a line down that side right there. And at the top of the page, I want you to write my faults. So I did, you know. And so we're starting, and I give the resentment, the cause, the effect. And he says, okay, good. Now, were you at fault? Where am I at fault? I just told you what they did. Yeah, but the book right here, the book. It says now we're ready to look at it from an entirely different angle. Where were we at fault? Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking. You see right here in the book it says that. I never looked at it that way, I told him. Okay, so were you at fault? And I remember what felt like an eternity sitting there thinking to myself, I wasn't at fault. And I believed that. He said, when did this happen? I said, oh, when I was about five or six years old. He said, and you've been carrying it around for 20 years. You've been using it as an excuse to hurt other people and justify your life, and you have no faults? I never looked at it that way, I told him. That's right. Ego, that's your ego. And he writes on that Big Chief tablet, I-G-O, ego, that's your ego. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that root. That's your ego. And so I sat and I thought, okay, he said, what's the next one? And I said, I'll go down the next one, you know. What, okay, were you at fault? Ego? That's right, that's right. Selfish and self-centered, selfish little boy. That's your ego, your ego. And we'd go down, boom, 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 one right after the other. Ego, 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 selfish, 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 self-centered, self-centered. I'm like, I thought you're supposed to feel good when you do this step, Roger. Don't you worry, don't you worry. He says, you see, the root, the root, the root. If you take a peach, Joe, and you put it in the ground, what does it grow? Peaches? He said, that's right. And if you take pecans and you put the pecan in the ground, what does it grow? Pecans? I told you, that's right. And it grows peaches because the root of the peach is the peach. It knows it's a peach tree. And the root of your tree, Joe, is selfishness and self-centeredness. And the fruit that you bear is selfish and self-centered. And everything you do to justify your ego. Everything you do is about trying to fix and get everything all square on the outside so that your ego will be satisfied. But you can't satisfy. It's a Skid Row wino, man. Where'd he get this? The root, the root, the root. We're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good, he says. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. And he got up and he walked over and this little tiny apartment, he cut the lights off. And he turned around and he started walking back over towards me. And there was a chair, an ottoman, there was a plant, a lamp. And he boom, 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 starts knocking everything over. And everything's falling over, the plant, the chair. And I said, Roger, what are you doing? He says, I can't see nothing, it's dark. I said, Roger, you only got one eye. He says, I can't see nothing in the dark. He says, I'm in collision with something or somebody, even though I'm just trying to get from one side of the room to the other. I'm not intentionally trying to hurt anybody or anything. I'm just in collision because I'm blinded by the darkness, Joe. He said, you live in the darkness of your own ego. You live blinded by your own thinking. You live in the darkness of what you think to be real. And he walked back over to the light. He turned it back on. He walked over to the lamp. He lifted it back up. He picked up the chair, the ottoman, the plant. Walked back over to the light switch. Turned it off again. And he stood there and he turned around and he looked at me and he said, do you know what the hardest thing in the world for an alcoholic to do is, Joe? He said, to do nothing at all. And wait on the light. You see, the light knoweth no darkness. And that light that was coming in above that curtain and the flashing VCR, it lit the room. And I was catapulted. I was rocketed into a dimension of existence I cannot explain to you. I no longer lived in the dark. I wasn't like this because I didn't get a book. I was, and he said, Joe, you're no better, no less. You're just one of God's kids, mijo. We're all the same. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I don't need a drink to feel that way anymore. And I stood in the light. I said, Roger, what do you do next? He said, that's what the rest of the steps are for. We ask God to remove our defects of character. I get a kick out of this, and I say this, you know, that one of the shortest paragraphs in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is step 7, y'all. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. My creator, I'm now ready that you should have all of me, good and bad. Remove the things that stand in the way of my usefulness to you. Yet I go out thinking it's up to me to manage what needs to go next. God is he's my pruner. God is my gardener.
It's not up to me to fix myself what's next. I just yield to that power. And the next thing I know, when I stand and do nothing, he shows me what to do next. And then it goes like this. If you're a drunk and you're a horse thief, you're a drunk horse thief. If you quit drinking, you're still a horse thief. Until you take the horses back. You see, I can't have freedom in my life when I have a corral full of your horses. I live in the darkness when I've got this corral following me everywhere I go. So I got to come back and say, Vince, here's your horse, man. He's a little skinny now, but I promise you, I'm going to feed him. And now all of a sudden, that burden that drove me, the heebie-jeebies, no longer mine. I took it back to its place, and I begin to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And I begin to not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it anymore. And I'm living in the light. And when these things crop up, this is what Roger told me. He said, now when you screw up, Joe, you're going to screw up good. Because you're going to know. You're going to know when you do it. That's what the 10th step is about for me. And the 11th step, I went to this other friend of mine one day and I told him, man, I just seem to not be able to kind of get my stuff together, man. My apartment's always a mess. Everything's over. He said, Joe, just go home and turn right. He said, if your shoes are on the floor, pick up your shoes and take them to the closet. He said, and then as soon as you take them to the closet, turn right again. If your clothes need to be picked up and put into the laundry, put them in the laundry and turn right. And then if the trash needs to be taken out, take the trash out and turn right. What used to be an occasional hunch or inspiration now gradually becomes a working part of the mind, this book tells me. And I just turn right. And then one day, somehow or another, I end up in Southern California. If you're that one person that I'm here to carry that message to, I pray that you know that you never have to live that way again. The darkness is your own perception. You're only 12 steps away from coming from the darkness to the light. And we're going to go there with you, baby. I can't go there for you, but I'll lead you by the hand and I'll show you what was done for me. It came from this. I was sitting with having a cup of coffee at the Arid Club with Bob. Me and Bob are sitting there, and he says, Joe, you know, I think I got a problem. And now he's got a haircut, you know, he's got clean clothes, he's got a, you know, I got my own apartment. He says, I got a VCR. He said, I can't keep the girls away. He says, but let me take you outside and show you something. So he takes me outside, and he shows me this 10-speed bike, and he says, there she is, that's the Betsy. I'll keep a little air in the tires. I'll put some chain on her. I'll put some oil on the chain, and she's good to go. Take me anywhere I want to go. Never ever argues. He said, but I got a problem, Joe. I said, well, what's that, Bob? He says, they want to quit calling me Hobo Bob. And they want to call me Bicycle Bob. I said, well, you know, change is good, Bob. That's what the program's all about. He said, yeah, I think so. So let me ask you a question, Bob. You remember when you first came? He said, oh, yeah, I used to sit in that chair back over there. Yeah, man. He said, oh, yeah. I used to sit in that chair back there, and he said, you know, somebody bought me a hamburger one day, and they said, just keep coming back one day at a time. It gets better. Been here ever since. So I know. I said, the grease spot's still on the wall, man. I said, how long... Where did you live at that time? He said, you know that bridge down by the Rio Grande? I said, oh, yeah. I lived under that bridge. I said, how long did you stay there? Year and a half. Year and a half. I just go there and come back to these meetings. He said, oh, I could hardly wait for Saturdays. He said, I had the Danish and those cheesecakes and donuts and stuff. Sometimes that was all I ate all week. And I thought to myself, who am I to judge this guy? You see, we're all the same. No better, no less. That guy 12-stepped me by example, purely by example. He's no better, I'm no better. He's no less, I'm no less. Just one of. And he hopped on that bike and he rode off. And I just looked at God's precious child and I thought about Roger telling me, "Mijo, you're just one of God's perfect kids. You're only 12 steps away. Don't quit before the miracle happens." Thanks.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.